Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, your summer breeze in an otherwise sticky world of technology podcasts. This is The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week we're going to tell you how to get something for nothing. But is the freemium model, where you get a pared-down version of a premium service for no exchange of funds, realistic? Well, we asked Chris Anderson, Wired's editor and author of Free, The Future of a Radical Price, what he thinks. And we'll also be asking whether interacting in our everyday design, the internet in the refrigerator, for example, if that is the future. Joining me to dissect these issues and more is Robert Andrews, editor of Paid Content UK, and John Rogers from the University of Dundee. Welcome to the pod. Robert, so are the best things in life actually free?
I think that human beings are driven by a couple of things, like the desire to seek out shelter, food, and I think the desire to save money is one of them as well. So I think on the consumer side, absolutely, people love getting free stuff.
And John, what's the best thing you've ever got for free?
The best thing I ever had for free was, I think it was just jumping in the North Sea and getting really, really cold.
But you paid for it later with
lots of whiskey.
I'll definitely pay for it later. Well, keep listening for these stories and more. Yes, more news, more feedback, more analysis from John, from Robert, and from me on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In the early days of the internet, when the web was a twinkle in the eye of a few technophiles in computer labs around the world, the idea was that this new tool would usher in a new libertarian system where all data, all information would be free. Since then, the web has been capitalized, and entrepreneurs have scrabbled around trying to figure out the best business model to sustain them and their families on the global network of bits and bytes. But there is a conflict. The internet user has been weaned on an expectation of free stuff, content, information, data, and the threat imposed by big business to start charging for services that we've enjoyed for over a decade is challenging those entrepreneurs' livelihoods. And so a new online business model has emerged, freemium. Give away something for nothing and you will be sustained by a committed user base. But in the current climate, is this a business model that actually is sustainable? Charles Arthur spoke with Chris Anderson, editor of Wired and author of the new book Free, The Future of a Radical Price, about exactly what entrepreneurs were giving up when they let people have their stuff for free. He started by asking, what has been the effect of free?
The main effect has been you get a lot more of everything. I mean, you know, the old model was that everything needed a business model to get out there. So, you know, only professional media got through the scarce distribution channels of the 20th century, radio, television, print, etc.
And there was a big cost barrier in actually getting out through that.
A very big cost barrier and also a kind of a credential barrier. You needed to have gotten into the professional media organizations to get your stuff out there. What free did, and by free I mean sort of, again, both liberty and no cost, what opening the tools of production to everybody did is got a lot of stuff out of there, including a lot of stuff that would not have otherwise passed the professional media test. And so the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the blogging and the Twittering, et cetera, is essentially, you know, sharing the distribution channels of media with professional media and presenting a huge amount of competition. And more to the point, a lot of content that we didn't think people wanted, but in fact it's proving they do want.
So media then, the sort of the traditional media, so to speak, is that threatened by this enormous growth in content? Or is it something that it can use? Is there a way to, in effect, make money from free?
And that is, in fact, what the book is about. I mean, the observation that information wants to be free is now coming up 30 years old. The observation that the underlying economics of digital distribution allows things to be free is also decades old. What we're getting smart about is how to make money from free. The idea of making money from free is also 100 years old. That's called advertising. In the U.S., all of our radio is free to air and it's advertising supported, and our television is all broadcast free. You can pay for cable, but it's broadcast for free. And it's all supported by a third party, the advertiser. And in economics, that's called a two-sided market, and one party subsidizes the other, and that's fine. You know, the first wave of the internet was simply applying the media model, just slap advertising against things and hope that that'll pay the way. Then we got as smart when we invented a new form of advertising with Google. And that became a better way of slapping ads against things. And it worked really well for Google, but didn't really work that well for anybody else. And now we're having to invent a new way of making money from free, and that's called freemium. And it's not new either, but people are getting much smarter about it. And freemium is free plus premium, where you have a free version and a premium version. You give away the free version to 80%, 90% of your audience, and then you convert maybe 10 or 20% to paid users. And that is that's where all the really interesting innovations happening. A lot in the games world, but in software, as software becomes a service, you're seeing freemium become the default model. And I think that may be the future of media as well.
So is your book going to be free?
My book is going to be free. Well, you know, it's interesting. What is a book? So a book is, you know, the hardcover edition, and the marginal cost of that is non-zero. So the price will be non-zero. It varies from place to place, but that's not going to be free. But then the book is also bits. The book is also digital editions, and all of those will be free in one form or another. So the ebooks will be free but time limited, so free for a week or two. And then you pay. The web version on Google Books will be free for, again, a time limited. The audiobook, if you buy the hardcover, you get the abridged audiobook, the 3-hour version, for free. Mm-hmm. If you don't buy the hardcover, or anybody can have the unabridged version, the whole book, 6 hours. For free.
Why is it that the abridged version is sort of more, quote, valuable? Because that you have to get the hardcover first.
You can buy it as well. Well, you know, this is an experiment. We'll figure it out. I'm guessing that time is money, and that for $14 or whatever it costs, that you're getting back 3 hours of your life.
Yeah. Are you going to be annoyed if the abridged version starts popping up on Pirate Bay and so on?
Well, so I own the rights to that, so I can speak for myself in that case. No, I would not be annoyed. I'm not going to put it there myself. But to give you an example, The Long Tail, my previous book, I was told that it was the most pirated business book in China in 2007, and I was incredibly delighted by that. For a couple reasons. First of all, I wasn't intending to put my children through college based on the Chinese royalties anyway. So I wasn't really expecting any money from that. The second is that piracy is a form of organic marketplace response, organic marketplace demand that feels really quite authentic to me. The fact is that pirates in China, you know, took that book, they cut the pages, they photocopied them, scanned them, they reprinted them, they bound them, and they distributed them so that they sat there on stalls, you know, folding tables. Somebody sat there all day, and of the books they chose to put on that table and to stand behind all day, one of them was mine. I feel quite proud about that.
And the way that you're looking at the cost of the audiobook, that costs you something between $20,000 and $25,000 to do. Mm. Where do you get the payback from having spent that money yourself?
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out. What I want to do is I want to use free for what it's best at, which is to maximize the audience. I want the barrier to entry to my book to be zero. You know, one way or another, everybody out there can read the book if they want to, and they don't have to pay a penny. Now, they may choose to pay for a quote-unquote superior form, but they don't have to. If I can use free to propagate my ideas around the world to millions of people, and that's arrogant of me to assume that millions of people will be interested, but if I could, and then I have the problem of converting that celebrity into money through some way yet to be determined, that's a problem I'm very happy to have.
It sort of sounds like the model is you become a celebrity. So people sort of say, hey, it's that Chris Anderson guy, I don't know. So it's almost as if one can look at the way, you know, celebrities are photographed falling out of nightclubs as this is actually them extending their brand so that they become more valuable when they do something for which they are getting paid.
Fundamentally, we're in the sort of the celebrity and micro-celebrity age these days, in that we use all the tools at our disposal, starting with the economic model of free and also, you know, the Twitters and the Facebooks and the blogging and everything else out there to promote ourselves, if I can say that without sounding, you know, incredibly craven.
And Malcolm Gladwell took you to task in The New Yorker in the latest issue, saying that that to call free a sort of a law of economic gravity, to him it doesn't hold up. He thinks the law of economic gravity works in rather the other direction, that eventually stuff has to be paid for. Someone's paying the bills. That, you know, he sort of took the example of YouTube, where someone's estimated to lose $500 million. He said, you know, actually, YouTube is, you know, if it was a bank, it'd be eligible for TARP funds. What's your response to that?
You know, my response is that it's early days. I agree. Everything, you know, that you know, fundamentally the cost must be repaid. And the question is not, is not that they shouldn't. I mean, I think it's a misunderstanding of free that you don't make money of free. The book is entirely about how to make money from free. Now, we have not solved that with YouTube. We have not figured out what the advertising model is that can support YouTube. But, you know, this is a very postmodern problem. The audiences shift before the business models do. So the advertising industry has not figured out how to create video ads that are as effective as Google's text ad. When we figure that out, when the advertising industry figures out how to advertise on YouTube, I suspect YouTube will, in fact, make money.
And just generally, what are the lessons from free for the traditional media, for the newspapers, for the radio?
I think we're going to have to sort of slice what we do into lots of different forms. Now, what we're doing right now is not The Guardian in print. It's not The Guardian on the web. It's a podcast version. Now, all these things are free, but you know, what does The Guardian represent? You know, is there some element of this which could be turned into a product? Could it be the book or the conference or the community or maybe some retail, you know, presence or the discount or
the T-shirt
exactly. Well, you know,
the sandals.
Unfortunately, T-shirts are close to advertising and being the ubiquitous business model when you don't have a business model. So I think that we media are going to have to find ways to slice and dice what we do, and find some way to package things that people will pay for.
That was Charles Arthur with Chris Anderson offering some advice to The Guardian. So Robert, tell me, is free realistic?
Yeah, free is realistic. One of the freemium models is advertising funding. And, you know, we've had newspapers and magazines and radio stations being funded by advertising for many, many years. That model is challenged right now, purely because advertising's in a recession. But a lot of people think that's going to recover in 2010. And, I think we're going to be seeing ad-supported media for many years, but also technology products, both the open source kinds of software that we use and increasingly the cloud-hosted apps. I've totally drunk the Google Apps Kool-Aid, as I believe the Americans say, that's a freemium model. I use Gmail, Google Docs, it's all free. They have a premium model that I never need to touch because I'm not a big-time user. Yeah, I think it's here to stay.
Now, John, you're involved with product design. I was wondering what you thought about this notion of giving something away for free.
It's an interesting question. I think that most of the things that we do, we start any conversation you give for free. You meet people. It's kind of free time. You exchange things. So I think when we start out in life, things are free. So, yes, I think we all kind of lend ourselves towards giving stuff away for free. But once we've become hooked on things and started building those relationships, it becomes, well, actually, it's not free anymore. And maybe my time's worth a bit more than it was. Maybe my life's sort of got there and I've got a mortgage to pay. At the end of the day, things have to be accounted for.
Robert, we're always engaging in a transaction anyway on the web. You know, things generally aren't free because what we give up, whether it's our, you know, information about our click stream or whether it's photographs that are on Facebook, profile content, we're actually already paying for a lot of that stuff. So when Chris Anderson talks about giving stuff away to your consumer, your potential buyer, are they not being disingenuous because, in fact, we are engaged in a transaction there?
I don't know about disingenuous, as some of these companies say, well, we've got our terms and conditions there on the website. But no, you're right. Most people don't know that when they visit a website, perhaps that website is using cookies to track their browsing behavior so they can better target ads. But the fact that people don't know that, maybe that's the sign of a perfect system, just like in product design.
Do you think, though, that people will feel comfortable paying for content, though? After all, we tried this, we tried this a while ago and people said, don't like that. They're happy enough to give, you know, maybe their names and their locations. But when it comes to actually giving cashola, they're a little bit less comfortable with that.
I think in content, the vast majority of general consumers, readers, won't be comfortable paying. The high-end business readers of publications like the Wall Street Journal and the FT, who regard that information as must-read, are obviously happy to pay. Elsewhere in technology, we do see, you know, we've all got iPhones here, and a heck of a lot of people are paying to download apps. Theory goes if it's made easy enough, and if the apps are good enough, people will pay to download those.
Everywhere we look, everything around us has been carefully crafted. The buttons we push, the chairs we sit on, the headphones that sit in our ears, you can trace everything back to industrial product designers. And once you start looking around, realizing that someone has designed the screws that holds the wall together, or the indentations on the keyboard, you've opened up Pandora's box. You will never be able to look at the world with an ignorant eye again. Now, increasingly, product design is integrating technology into it. So, for example, we've got internet-enabled refrigerators. We've got fuel consumption feedback for cars, you know, that has been changing people's behaviors. But are these necessary advances or are they overkill? John, you are the course director of product design at the University of Dundee. Can you tell me, first of all, why you believe product design is important? And then we'll get to the question of whether integrating the internet into, you know, my fridge is overkill.
Without products, what are we going to use? How are we going to access things? Are you going to drive in your car? Are you going to put your shoes on to walk down the road? Are you going to read a book? If you think of a product in the mathematical sense as something that's an outcome, then, well, that's everything, as you said, you know, from the screw in the wall to the wall itself. Where design comes into it is, well, you want someone to think about the stuff that you're going to be using. It's a little bit kind of frustrating when you try and put the screw in the wall, but it doesn't match the hole that someone's put the drill bit to put it in, to use your screw metaphor. The way products are viewed at the moment, or traditionally, is nouns, that they are a thing. So you will look at designing a chair, a car, a bike, a tap, a screw. What technology has taught us, and really subjects such as interaction design, which is kind of any evolution or convergence of where media meets products through technology, you start to think of things as verbs. So not what they are, but what they do. And that's when it becomes quite exciting. So you don't try and design something to take you home. You don't design a compass. You're designing something that might take you on a journey or help you explore. And then it becomes a very different product.
So, John, you're down here because there's a show. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about the some of the things that are on display at the show?
Yeah, okay. So our students from Dundee, we go to a show called New Designers. It's part two of New Designers, which is product design and industrial design and other areas of kind of physical design. What our course is really about is the bringing in of technologies into people's lives. So studying how people behave in order to have something meaningful and sensitive and ultimately that will have value. There's, broadly speaking, kind of two main categories to our work. Because we're in a mechanical engineering department, our students will play around with the mechanics. And mechanics kind of, it's interesting, 10 years ago people said, oh, no more mechanics, everything's going to be digital, which is kind of true, but sustainability has taught us that actually we're going to value mechanics more than we used to. So we've got a student who is grinding flour to make bread from a bicycle. The technical innovation in that is actually incredible. The social innovation is working with Britain's best bread maker, this guy called Andrew Whitley, who is a craft bread maker, and it's all about the health of the food. We've got a coffee roaster and grinder and maker so that you can make the perfect kind of cup of coffee. On the digital side, one of our students, Jasmine, started to look at what does it mean to put GPS in a product? Does that take you home quicker, faster, easier, or are our lives going to be a little bit richer than that? Do we want a product as Jasmine's design, which it could take you home very easily and very quickly, but you could change the setting and it will get you completely lost. It will take you on an adventure, an exploration, a journey. Valuing those things in our lives, that it isn't always about being there on time. Serendipity is fantastic. Being late is one of the raison d'etre, you know.
Do you see any of these products going to market, though? So, for example, I remember seeing a brilliant bicycle-powered washing machine several years ago and thought, That looks fantastic, but I've never actually seen it go to market. So, you know, the flour grinder, are we going to see these things in shops?
Okay,
will it be in Comet?
Is it about taking it to market? Is it about making that next killer app, that product that everyone's going to buy? Or are we trying to influence the market? Fashion students have never tried to make the next sellable thing. It's always been about influencing fashion. So what we're trying to do in product design is maybe we're not saying that everybody has a GPS device that helps you get lost or a doorbell that you can download your own ringtone to and mechanically play it. What we're saying is these are the technologies and these are the kind of environments that people want to play in. Look at them, think about them more sensitively and take them on to the next step. So we see it as a they could be market ready if people were kind of prepared for kind of quite far out stuff, or they could be influencing the future. And I think that's where we position ourselves.
Who do you see at the moment as really great designers out, perhaps within, you know, within your pool of students, or perhaps on a wider scale?
Yeah, I'm going to promote my students, first of all. The three or four students that are really going to make a big impact are, I've mentioned Jasmine already. Jasmine Cox's GPS device is fantastic. It's great to see female students sketching with code and technology in order to make playful objects. And that's kind of fairly new to kind of product design sphere. On the other side of it, we've got Tom Metcalf's coffee maker. It literally does make the best cup of coffee in the world. And you will come and see it there and you will try it, because you can roast the green beans yourselves. The beans go off. Roasted beans go off in a day or two. Ground beans go off in an hour or two. If you buy green beans, they last for a year. So if you can roast them at your table, it takes 7 minutes. You've got the perfect coffee how you want it. People like Naoto Fukasawa and Jasper Morris and Jonathan Ive, they're great designers, but everybody knows about them. Sorry, guys, but we do. So for me, it's exciting to see how my students have been influenced by that kind of scale of design, what someone like Jonathan Ive can do for a company like Apple.
I was wondering if you could highlight some of your personal favorite design interfaces that are out there in the product sphere, in the technology product sphere today.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the projects that I saw from students a few years ago at the Royal College of Art was basically sticking stickers on things that had too many buttons. Okay, so the first thing is let's take away the buttons. I kind of like buttons. I like the retro gaming. I miss that from my iPhone. But I think the things that are going to be making a difference in terms of the interfaces are where we learn from the web and we start to put that into products. So when we look at an interface such as Google, it's intuitive. You know where to search. You know how to use it. Put that back into products. How then do you search a real space? How do you search your city to find someone? How do you do that physically? What would be the interface for that? How can we learn from the web? What happens when people start making physical apps that plug into your iPhone? What will that do? Well, we have amazing jigsaws that plug into our iPhone, and you can start carving out the table and making the shapes you want because it's controlled by your iPhone. Or does the iPhone sit in a car and your car starts driving around? So it's that interface between, that space where people understand how to use the media and the web and the technologies there, and they learn from it and they start putting in technology, and it starts driving that way of how products will be used with technology in them.
One of the things I find interesting is crossover between designs and how some designs influence each other. So, for example, the influence of iPhone's touchscreen. Not to bang on about the iPhone.
I know, but there are other smartphones available, by the way.
But I was using a video recorder yesterday, the Flip video cam, and was trying to use the damn thing and started actually punching and poking its screen, and of course it didn't respond because it's not a touchscreen. So I find this cross-pollination quite interesting, and also how a design that has been intended for one purpose, as you said, actually can come to accommodate multiple functions. So PC was designed with a very narrow use set in mind, but has become our TV, our radio, our newspaper. So what a single design is now inhabiting multiple kinds of purposes.
Tell me again where the show is. And
so the New Designers Show is at the Islington Business Centre. It runs from it's open to the public from the 16th of July to the 19th of July.
Excellent. Well, you can find more information about that on our website, where we'll have plenty of links. And that's guardian.co.uk/techweekly. So what has been going on the blogs? Robert, have you managed to find anything in particular on the blogs?
Yeah, one thing that happened last week is the Pirate Bay. A buyer came in for the Pirate Bay. A little heard of Swedish gaming company actually said it wants to stump up cash for this website, this BitTorrent tracker that is the scourge of the entertainment business, and it wants to legitimise it, and it wants to start paying the rights holders for the content that it carries. A lot of people are sceptical that this will work, and some commenters on paid content are sceptical. David says this whole deal smells fishy, and Mark says this is outrageous, and people say that crime doesn't pay. Well, it does.
Well, there you go. Well, over on the Games blog, we were a little bit more retrospective. We were missing Michael Jackson, I have to say, as was the rest of the world, it seemed. But many people don't realize that while he was the king of pop, he was also the master of computer games. He was all over the computer game thing in the 80s. It looks like you didn't know that, Rob.
Shamon.
No, seriously. Shamon, indeed. No, he was literally all over the place. I can't even count the number of games on one hand. It's got to be two hands that he was involved in or featured in or starred in. Not to mention the fact that he had just countless arcade boxes in his house. So, anyway, we've done enough about Michael Jackson and his gaming thing, but we were talking about that on the games blog. Lots and lots of reminiscing was going on. And my favorite comment was from Chubster 2010, who was talking about the Moonwalker game, which was an arcade box where you got to do all kinds of cool things, including moonwalk. And I have to read this in a voice that I imagine Chubster would have written. But this was his comment. He says, "I am a robotic Michael Jackson gunning down crackheads. Video games are cool, aren't they?" Anyway, that's what we've been doing on the games
blog. So do you think there's going to be a revival of Michael Jackson games now?
I hope so. There's all kinds of really good retro stuff that is really coming back. And in fact, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I read somewhere that he was going to be getting involved with the game again, and then his untimely death occurred. So who knows? There may be some bootleg code out there with Michael Jackson's name on it.
So. There's got to be something for your iPhone where you can actually moonwalk with your fingers.
Oh, you've just TM. Given somebody that idea. You've just given somebody that idea.
That's for free.
Yeah.
But then give me a paid lecture talking about how you do it.
Well, if you've got something to say and you just have to say it, then do get in touch. If for all the links that you need to contact us, head over to guardian.co.uk/audio/techweekly. Well, that's all for this week. I'd like to thank our guests, Robert Andrews, John Rogers, and Chris Anderson for joining in the fun. Thanks also to Charles Arthur for pinning Mr. Anderson down, and of course to Scott, our producer. Now, I'm off for a couple of months to finish my thesis. So I'm not going to have a baby like Jemima is. I'm going to have a different kind of baby. But in the meantime, you will be in safe hands. They will be guiding you through the summer's technology news. Next week, for example, Bobby Johnson will be podcasting a San Francisco special. So if those aren't good hands and arms and a big, lovely San Francisco hug, I don't know what is. Anyway, until September, I'm Alex Kratowski. See you then.